Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi there and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Now, if you've been listening recently, you'll know that I've been talking a little bit about China, Japan and the Second World War, and the fact that the popular perceptions of China's role in the war are, from a Western perspective anyway, fairly inaccurate for the most part. And the position that China has as being one of the four main wartime allies largely gets overlooked. The position in some kind of Western perspectives of the Soviet role in the Second World War gets downplayed, so it's hardly surprising that China is really seen as little more than a victim of Japanese aggression. when war films and war sort of media were produced in the post-war era. American war effort tended to focus on things like the Philippines and the battles in the Pacific, and the British often looked at the war in Burma. And obviously, a much bigger theatre than either of those things was the Japanese war in China. Countries are kind of very much centred on their own narratives, and this is only natural and normal. But we need to, as a kind of serious observers of history, try to look at it from a kind of a wider perspective, which is why I'm returning to Rainer Mitter's brilliant book, China's War with Japan. And he writes, "The ability to reinterpret the story of China's war with Japan enables us to move away from melodrama. Instead, the war should be understood as a disruption to a much longer process of modernization in China. By the 1930s, after nearly a century of foreign invasion, domestic strife and economic uncertainty, both nationalists and communists wanted to establish a politically independent state with a government that penetrated throughout society, a population that was stable, healthy and economically productive. It was the nationalists who first tried to achieve these goals in the decade before the war broke out in 1937, but the Japanese invasion made it almost impossible for them to succeed. From tax collection to provision of food security to the ability to cope with massive refugee flows, the problems were probably too great for any government to manage successfully. The war then marks the transfer of power to the communists, but there was nothing inevitable about the process. And for much of the early part of the war, before Pearl Harbor, there was an alternative, the possibility that Japan might win and that China would become part of a wider Japanese empire. The new history of China's wartime experience must take account of the three-way struggle for modern China: nationalist, communist, and collaborationist." So, one of the things that we kind of ignored at our peril, particularly when we look at the development of Soviet communism, the revolution of 1917, and the Chinese rise to power in 1949, is, you know, the traditional standard sort of Marxist-Leninist or Maoist historiography paint these things as inevitable parts of it, of kind of historical processes, but really there's nothing inevitable about either. Had it not been, and Mao acknowledged this himself, had it not been for the invasion of Japan, by Japan, of China, the conditions for Maoist victory in 1949 probably would not have been there, even with Stalin's intervention. But that, there we go into the realm of counterfactuals. But it's just to say that there is nothing inevitable about a regime of any stripe establishing itself. And the war created historic opportunities that Mao quite skillfully took advantage of by ultimately allowing the nationalists to do the bulk of the fighting and withholding forces for the end of the civil war that he knew would follow a Japanese defeat. "Such a history," writes Rainer Mitter, "must also restore China to its place as one of the four principal wartime allies, alongside the US, Russia and Britain. China's story is not just the account of the forgotten Allied power, but of the Allied power whose government and way of life was most changed by the experience of war. Even the massive loss of life in Russia that followed the German invasion in June 1941 was less transformative than what happened to China in one fundamental sense. Russia was pushed to its ultimate test, but did not break. It fought back and survived. In contrast, the battered, punch-drunk state that was nationalist China in 1945 had been fundamentally destroyed by the war with Japan. Western condemnations of the Chinese war effort, and the role of the nationalists in particular, had been based on accusations that the regime was too corrupt and unpopular to engender support. A popular American wartime joke declared that Chinese leader's name was really Cash My Check. The truth was more complex. The Europe First strategy meant that China was to be maintained in the war at minimum cost and Chiang was repeatedly forced to deploy troops in ways that served Allied geostrategic interests but undermined China's own war aims. The crippled and unsympathetic nationalist regime that limped to peace in 1945 was not a product of blind anti-communism, refusals to fight Japan, a bizarre accusation considering the nationalists' role in resisting alone for 4.5 years before Pearl Harbor, or foolish or primitive military thinking. The regime was overwhelmed by external attack, domestic dislocation, and unreliable allies. So, there is an awful lot written about the role of China in the China-India-Burma region. The two great books that I've often cited in the past, Harper and Bailey's Forgotten Wars and Forgotten Armies, and that is really about Britain's war in Southeast Asia, but it's about much, much more. And there was deployment of Chinese forces into parts of that theatre, particularly the Kuomintang, the Flying Tigers, the Kuomintang Air Force that was equipped and trained by the US. So often the British and the Americans were at odds with one another about strategy in Southeast Asia, but certainly the one thing they both agreed on was whether it suited China was kind of irrelevant to both of them. China's war with Japan also repays re-examination, because wartime conditions shape society in ways that have persisted even to the present day, writes Rademacher. Constant air raids made it imperative that people should live and work in the same spot. It was dangerous to move around. After 1949, work units would impose a similar system across China, which would not be dismantled until the 1990s. Chinese society became more militarized, categorized, and bureaucratized during the harsh years of the war, when governments struggled to keep some kind of order in the midst of chaos. These tendencies, along with an almost pathological fear of disorder, continue to shape the official Chinese mindset. The greater demands that the state made on the society in wartime also created a reverse effect. Society began to demand more from government. Something that, of course, we see around the world in the aftermath of the Second World War, that societies, individuals, come to see the state as a solution to social and economic injustices and problems, and they rightly view the state as having the power to make seemingly impossible happen, which is essentially what happens during the Second World War. Rademacher points out that during the Second World War, the British, for example, had created demands for social welfare and health care that only a radical transformative agenda could fulfill after the war. However, the nationalists had created similar demands in China, and it was not within their ability to actually bring these transformations about, though it does appear in the eyes of many Chinese people to be something that the Communist Party could achieve. The nationalists really promised, and this is part of their downfall after 1945, they really promised to the Chinese people more of the same. They weren't able to match their military deployments with the kind of political deployments. They weren't able to have a meaningful political offer to the Chinese people, which is why suddenly the pendulum of popularity shifts towards the communists in about 1946-47. In the early 21st century, writes Rademacher, China has taken a place on the global stage and seeks to convince the world that it is a responsible great power. One way in which it has sought to prove its case is to remind people of a time past, but not long past, when China stood alongside the other progressive powers against fascism. The Second World War, If we wish to understand the role of China in today's global society, we would do well to remind ourselves of the tragic Titanic struggle which that country waged in the 1930s and 40s, not just for its own national dignity and survival, but for the victory of all the Allies, West and East, against some of the darkest forces that history has ever produced. So, Rademacher goes on to discuss the fact that the war between China and Japan, 1937 onwards, had deep historical roots. It wasn't something that had simply kind of emerged from the ether in 1937. The rivalry between the two states, the sort of the love-hate relationship between the two states, had roots back into the 19th century. He writes, "The clash between China and Japan did not begin in 1937. It had been brewing for decades. The story of the first half of China's 20th century is a story of its love-hate relationship with its smaller island neighbour. The hatred became more prominent as the years went on, reaching its climax with the devastation visited on China's territory by the atrocities of the 1930s and 40s. But in earlier years, Japan had been mentor as well as monster. It was an educator. Thousands of Chinese students studied there. It was a refuge when Chinese dissenters, such as the prominent revolutionary Sun Yat-sen, were threatened by their own government. They fled to Tokyo. And it was a model. China's reformist elites looked to Japan to see how nation power could militarize, industrialize, and stand tall in the community of nations. For good or ill, a large proportion of the history of the 20th century China was made in Japan. It had become a commonplace in both countries that Japan and China were as close as lips and teeth." So there was a kind of a strain of, perhaps you could call it progressive nationalism, in Japan in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, a progressive Pan-Asianism that saw Japan as having achieved something that nearly all of Asia had failed to. It had resisted colonialism, it had modernized, it had proved itself to be a formidable military power, defeating Russia in 1905, and it had seen off the West in ways that India, China, the Philippines and other places had failed to do so. Here, the Japanese thinkers, liberal and radical thinkers, thought it was a kind of a blueprint of good, a good example that the rest of Asia could be shown. And particularly, many Japanese looked on in horror at China and the way that China, since the 1840s, had been progressively defeated, quasi-colonized, and humiliated. And the Japanese were under no illusion that that was their fate as well. And it was ultimately, and if you read The Anxious Triumph by Donald Sassoon, he has an excellent way of discussing this, it was ultimately the fact that Japan is run by a samurai class, a warrior class, that the transformation to a modern, industrialized and militarized country is so successful, because they believed that it was either that or their annihilation. So there were plenty of Japanese intellectuals, politicians, and even military thinkers that thought that China would make the excellent student in the transition from feudalism to advanced industrialized modernity. There would inevitably, even with the most enlightened and benign attitudes, have been colonial relations between China and Japan. But this kind of Pan-Asianism, this strand of Pan-Asianism, didn't really entertain the violent, annihilatory, racial Pan-Asian imperialism that the Japanese military and political classes embrace by the late 1930s. It's quite different. Rademacher asks, "If they were so close, how did the two nations come to fight one of the bloodiest wars in history? To understand the origins of their conflict, we must return to the late 19th century. To be Chinese during this period was to face a depressing range of political problems, floods, famines, and foreign invasions among them. And looming all over these challenges was the greatest existential crisis in China's history. The country's elites had come to realize that they were no longer in charge of their own destiny. What had once been a self-confident civilization was now the victim of a new international system in which the industrialization and imperialism shaped the world. That decline was doubly difficult for many Chinese to understand because it seemed to have come about so quickly. Just a century earlier, many observers in the West had felt that China's empire was surely the greatest on earth. Voltaire, for one, had criticized his native France by comparing it unfavorably with China. For centuries, Chinese imperial dynasties had ruled over one of the most populous and sophisticated societies on earth. And for nearly 1,000 years, China had used a system of competitive examinations to recruit government bureaucrats long before such a system operated in the West. The cultural influence of China was at its zenith during this period. The orderly conservative philosophy of Confucianism was underpinning Chinese statecraft, spread across East Asia, shaping societies beyond China's borders, including Japan, Korea, and Southeast Asia. Chinese calligraphy, painting, and metalwork became renowned across the region, and the country developed a dynamic commercial economy. Goods such as exotic fruits from the warm south made their way to the sophisticated palaces of prosperous merchants in the cities of central and northern China. So the question for many Chinese as to how China had been brought so low the answer was really understood far better by the Japanese, who managed to avoid it. Again, the Donald Sassoon theory is that the difference between China and Japan was that, once again, Japan was ruled by a martial class, the samurai, who were able to galvanize the state's resources in the national defense, and the Chinese Mandarin class, the bureaucrats, the civil servants, who dismissed the threat of foreign power until it was too late, also viewed the possibility of industrialization and other modern innovations as a threat to its own institutional power. These were civil servants at their very worst, not wanting things to change. So the abject humiliation of China places it in a position where Japan, treated for centuries by China as a kind of an irrelevance, is able to take the lead as the intellectually, technologically, and industrially dominant power in Asia. And the ability in 1894 to defeat China, to seize control of Korea and Taiwan, and to establish itself as the dominant military power in Asia, is based on Japan's acceptance of the lessons of the West, the lessons of Western industrialized modernity. Rana Mitter writes, "The rulers of Japan, in contrast, began to feel vulnerable. Concerned about the arrival of Spanish and Portuguese missionaries eager to convert the Japanese to Christianity, led to the Tokugawa family, who ruled on behalf of the emperor, to impose a policy known as Kaikin, or Sakoku, from 1635. On pain of death, no Japanese were permitted to leave the country, and foreign trade was heavily restricted, with Dutch, Chinese, and Korean traders permitted only onto the artificial island of Dejima in Nagasaki Harbour and on outlying islands. The Chinese court was much less concerned about the threat from abroad when the British diplomat Lord Macartney attempted to open up trade between China and Britain in 1793. The emperor sent him away empty-handed, declaring loftily, 'We have never valued ingenious articles, nor do we have the slightest need for your manufactures.' Still, despite this imperial insouciance, China was highly integrated with the world economy and was very far from being closed or isolated. During the Qing dynasty, 1644 to 1912, the distinctive blue and white pottery of Jingzhen in central China graced elegant homes in 18th century Britain and France. The spread of new world crops such as sweet potato and maize enabled Chinese to move west and cultivate large parts of the territory that had previously been considered barren. Between 1700 and 1800, China's population doubled from 150 to 300 million people." So The question of the origins of conflict between China and Japan are rooted in these two different historical journeys and the different ways in which both powers responded to the challenge of westernized modernity. And the idea that Japan would naturally, having harnessed and managed to weaponize Western modernity and military and industrial power, would naturally be the hegemonic state in Asia in the 20th century. The irony, of course, is that following the war with America, it's the United States that becomes, until the 1990s, the hegemonic power in Southeast Asia. So there's a lot to explore here and a lot to unpack, and we're going to spend quite a lot of time over probably the rest of this year actually looking at China and Japan, because it's greatly sort of overlooked, and the tensions in that part of the world now and the long historical memories of grievance and anger are, I think, going to shape the 21st century in ways that right now are perhaps hard to predict. There's a great deal of anxiety over what's happening in the Ukraine, but let's not take our eye off Taiwan, because that, if anything, is an even more potentially volatile situation. And Japan, demilitarized since the end of the Second World War, which has gradually been moving back towards having its own fully functioning, if not army, then defense force, is preparing itself for the possibility of conflict with China in the next decade or decades. Anyway, this is a history podcast, not a soothsaying one, so we'll steer away from that. We're going to finish in a moment, but just to remind you guys that you can check out the podcast, the vast podcast archive at explaininghistory.org. And if you come and find our Facebook group, there's always a kind of an interesting article or so going up there. And I'll be blogging a few more articles in the next few weeks on the website. So do check us out. And obviously we rely on Patreon for a little bit of backing from our patrons. And we have a little ad revenue as well, which you'll have heard in this podcast. But any and all donations, gratefully, gratefully appreciated. Anyway, thanks so much. We'll finish there and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.